The Bridge, written by Neil Scott, performed by Beth Frieden and Andy Rossiter.
The apex of the bridge, the place where the green and white scarfs, football tops and teddy bears have been tied, is nearly 40 metres from the water below. I wonder, do these tributes sum up the tragedy of this lost life? I believe that some people who jump actually think it is a cry for help that will perhaps go heeded. A stinging belly flop into a swimming pool. They don't know that hitting the Clyde from so high up will leave remains not unlike those left if they had jumped from a multi-storey building for the Coast Guard to fish out. None of the 20 or so troubled souls that jump from the Erskine Bridge every year survive. The green and white tributes, flapping in the spring breeze, are what the people who left think sums up this poor person's life. Celtic Football Club was this person's being. They played last night. They were crap. They won, but they were playing a part-time team. A team like so many others in Scotland, made up of part-timers, Saturday footballers who have other jobs. Celtic is one of the richest football teams in the world and pays millions of pounds for its players. Before the game, I had called Suzanne. She sounded happy enough. She was drinking a bottle of Merlot, she said.
And watching a film about a wee vampire in Sweden.
Suzanne and I liked to walk in the local park, and on sunny days, took a bottle of Merlot with us and bought fish and chips and sat watching Glasgow walk by while we talked.
You watching the game tomorrow night then?
Aye. Do you want to come over and watch it with me? She screws up her face and turns and gives me a look of exaggerated disbelief.
You're joking? To your place?
I tidy up, like. She looks me up and down.
I noticed. You've had a decent haircut and ironed your jeans.
She turns her freckled face up to the sun and laughs. The view from the bench over the pond towards the hospital is, I suppose, nice.
Oh, anyways, me and the girls are going to have a night in, watching EastEnders and eating Pringles.
I only came to this park to meet Suzanne. This was out of my way. I had escaped Glasgow and lived in a wee council house in a suburban town called Milgai. I had escaped the decay left by the shipyard owners, who had bled their workers and then left to bleed cheaper labour on the other side of the world. I had hated the, "my da was a fitter," or "my da was a leckie," or "my da plumbed the QE2, from all the junkies who had been stripped of all hope of doing anything. My da had been more. He'd been a designer. He had designed ocean liners, tugboats, tankers and all sorts of huge ships that had fanned out across the oceans from Glasgow. When I had been wee, we'd lived in one of the big houses on the south side of Glasgow. I remember my ma laughing and running after us in the park, in her blue coat and her white open smile. I remember vaguely a couple of holidays in the sun. I remember him kicking the ball to me and splashing in the pool. I worried about his white skin being so pillar box red, I thought he would explode. I remember when he didn't return from the work trip to the States. When he eventually did, he was in a box, unseen. I guessed that the car crash had made him unrecognisable. I remember the move to govern and the teasing I got for being posh, something I had to quickly lose to survive. I remember the rest of my childhood as grey, overcast, heavy on my shoulders. I remember her lying in bed, lots, calling down the stairs for a cup of tea, thin, sick, depressed bones under the covers. My gran took me in and made me leave school for work when all I wanted to do was draw, paint and write stories. I worked in a chippy. Then I got an apprenticeship with a carpenter who remembered my da as a great gaffer. That year, we found alcohol and hash, tenants' lager, then bucky, and then blow, and then the pursuit for a bigger kick. When she died, her will said she didn't want me to sell her life's detritus to inject my scab-ridden arm with insanity. She had left us £15,000 or so, and I would only get it if I was clean and married with a Wayne. Our addiction, our lifestyle, was their fault. the capitalist bastards. So we broke into their homes and those who worked for them. Mostly those who worked for them, because they were easier. Their lifestyle would plunge the world into ruin, mine into perfect oblivion. We were the subversives, the real revolutionaries. We couldn't escape the system. We knew that. We weren't delusional like the God Squad, or the soapbox socialists, or the middle class anarchists. We knew that there was no hope. I would kill myself without my ma's money. No matter how much I pleaded, no matter how many times, stinking of piss and sick, I threw stones at my lawyer's window, they would keep my right from me. On those nights, after a thwarted housebreak, I would sit and shit and shiver and vomit until the chemist opened and I had had my methadone hit. I knew what she had done was actually some sort of an apology. Her way to say sorry for the wrong childhood. Her way to say thank you for the cups of tea and for listening to what would have been and what should have been. This was her way to parent me, to clean me up and create a life for new Waynes, a life she should have given me. At first I didn't bite. I just shouted and railed and smashed and kicked at her for making me suffer. Waking up in the Southern General to the words, "Don't revive the junkie," 2 weeks after my 25th birthday, changed everything. I wanted to be the da. I wanted to be the da splashing his wee fella. I wanted to complete a Wayne's childhood. Camping, cycling, scaletrics. The heart attack and the second class NHS citizenry took me out of my oblivion revolution. I asked for help. I wanted to be clean. I wanted to be something. I wanted to be part of the consumerist struggle and own things. The death that was cold turkey. The pain, the drama, gave way to nothingness. A being that I can only now describe as not being. After that, I was discharged from hospital, back to the piss-stained, rubbish-strewn hovel. It was months before I found a will beyond being, beyond eating the little I needed to survive, and then wanting something more. Something other than daytime TV, beans and toast. I met a cousin who was giving up her council flat in Milgai, and she allowed me to move in. When she left her flat, it was passed on to me. It was a lifesaver for a while. I managed to get a job in a local cafe, and with the small earnings and some top-ups from the brew, I began to crawl my way to acceptance and to real life. Suzanne used to come into the cafe. At first, I didn't notice her, but then she said things like,
"I prefer your white trainers."
Or,
"I saw you in the shelter shop looking at books yesterday."
She was attractive, in a left-field sort of way. She had long, black, straightish hair that she obviously cut herself. Sometimes it sat at a strange, gelled angles. Her face was really pale and freckled, and she stared at you with pale blue eyes which followed your every move and changed her expression with every word you said, depending on her interpretation of your emotions. And sometimes she dressed in scruffy, worn denims and t-shirts. Sometimes in strange skirt, stripy socks and flowery blouse combinations. And some days she came in and looked at you as if she didn't know you. A sad smile was all she gave in acknowledgement to anything you said to her. Our first date was to the pictures. We went to see Avatar. She cried. In fact, she was inconsolable. I left her to a taxi and she said,
"See you tomorrow."
I didn't. She hadn't given me a phone number. She came back to the cafe around a fortnight later.
"Hiya,"
she said, as if there had not been a moment between Avatar and now.
"Do you want to go to the park near where I stay?"
She opened her plastic bag and showed me the bottle of Merlot and two plastic cups. Okay. This was her way of showing me where she spent most of her time, Gap Naval Royal Hospital.
"Do you know, it used to be called the mental asylum. I'm mental."
I got to understand her condition. Some days she wanted to live so badly and madly she wouldn't meet me. Some days the medication gave her and us normality. Some days, weeks, she wouldn't come to see me. But I loved her. After her fish and chips and bottle of Merlot, I walked her back up the hill to the hospital. She stayed in one of the units behind the old Victorian building, but she never wanted me to go beyond it. We kissed, and she promised when she felt good, we would be together forever. The doctor said she could live well in the community, when she felt well enough. My flat was ready for that eventuality.
I hope the game goes well. Phone me.
I'd managed to get some decent second-hand furniture together, and I painted the hall and kitchen in her favourite purple. When she came to stay for the odd night, we would play Kate Bush CDs and fall asleep entwined in the couch. We were both happy. A Swedish vampire?
Aye, a wee girl. Some wee fella's falling for her. I'll phone you later.
She hung up. She didn't phone. I watched the game and I fell asleep on the couch waiting for the call. Then I phoned the next morning. It's a strange sensation. I am standing, or floating, I don't know which, here on the Erskine Bridge, reading cards left by junkies and family friends over the past week. They think Celtics sum up my existence. They didn't. She did. And when they told me she'd been found in the pond, her wrists slashed deeply, and her beautiful freckled face drained of life, I knew the golden life was not for me. I knew the £15,000 would go to someone else. She smiles and takes my hand.
I'll be happy now.
I smile, and we dissolve.